history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some pretty incredible stories out there that need to be told, that need to be heard, and we're not going to hear them unless we take the time to ask a few questions and listen. So each week we seek to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these members of our greatest generation. The gentleman we're going to meet today just returned from an honor flight to Washington, D.C. We're going to talk about that before we're done, but we're going to go way back to Southern California in the 1930s with 92-year-old Larry Cosgrove of Signal Hill, California. That's right in and around Long Beach in SoCal. And Larry, you grew up around Los Angeles, the San Fernando Valley, at a time where I'm sure it was much different from today. I think most of us, especially who don't live in L.A., think of the San Fernando Valley, and the first thing we think of is traffic. That probably wasn't the case in the 1930s, right?
No. We lived on a dirt street that had two ruts. If you went over 15 miles an hour, you'd be bounced out of the car.
And what kind of car would you be riding in back then?
Model A.
Of course.
Well, we had also had a 30 Chevy, but it had a pickup bed in the back. They took the rumble seat out. That was used for the truck farming.
And you had an older brother, and you and he were tasked with keeping up the chicken ranch there?
We did a lot of egg gathering. We had to go out in the morning and make sure the water containers were full of water. We did get, even though it was Southern California, there were days that it went below freezing and the water containers would freeze over, and they were round about 18 or 20 inches wide. We had to break the ice out of that so the chickens could get, or turkeys, we also had turkeys, and they could get to the water. So that was our duties there. But we worked in the fields too. My uncle did truck farming, which is raising vegetables, and just for people that don't know what truck farming is.
Sure.
So we worked in the fields too, but we had a lot of fun too. Didn't have to wear shoes to school. We walked to school until we got old enough to get bicycles and ride them.
You're still in Southern California, and Hollywood was up and running, and there were plenty of movie stars running around. Is that something that you were exposed to at a young age?
There were quite a few lived in the San Fernando Valley. As in fact, one of my first jobs was delivering the Hollywood Citizen News, and one of my customers was Noah Beery Jr. That was about the closest I got to any movie actors. And, of course, at that time, he wasn't really a star, but he did get parts in Western movies.
I know you have a sharp memory, but do you remember, as a boy, what dreams or hopes or ambitions you had about, hey, when I grow up, here are the things that Larry's going to go do?
Well, I fortunately had a fourth-grade teacher who believed that the world turned around because of mathematics. And if you learn mathematics, you learn logic, and therefore you'll be better shaped to learn anything. And so my aspiration, I had probably the richest relative in our family was an engineer who lived in Texas, worked for Texaco. So my aspirations were to learn as much math as I could so I could go and be an engineer when I grew up, go to college and get a degree and do something, build bridges, whatever.
And how did you and your big brother get along?
Well, he was a big brother.
So he toughened you up?
Well, a little bit, yes. But we would be out on a day when we didn't have school or didn't have jobs to do, and he would ask my mother, well, if he could go and visit some of the other kids, because we all lived maybe a mile or a mile and a half apart, because it was pretty much big spreads out there. She would say, oh, okay, but take your little brother. That made him miserable, so he wanted to make sure I was miserable. So, but he wasn't mean as far as hurting me in any way, but he wasn't always happy that I was along on his adventures.
You know, I've talked to a lot of folks who moved to the Los Angeles area during the Great Depression because things where they came from had gone south. But being in Southern California during those years when the economy turned sour, when jobs were hard to come by, when so many families were hurting, did you get a sense for that? Did you understand that things were changing?
Well, I was born in Los Angeles, and my father was a carpenter. My brother was already, he was a year and a half older. At that time, my father was an adamant union man, and there was a big effort in Los Angeles to break the union. In fact, there were a number of big development companies that were hiring non-union. And he had a brother-in-law who lived in Portland, Oregon, who said, "Hey, everything runs by the unions up here. Not a wheel turns if the union doesn't approve." So my father took my mother and his two boys, and we moved to Portland, Oregon. And when I was 5 years old, unfortunately, he was killed in a construction accident. I'm not sure exactly what happened, but in any case, he was killed. And my mother had two sisters and a brother that owned the chicken ranch in Van Nuys. And they told her, "You can't take care of the boys by yourself." So we moved back from Portland down to Los Angeles to the ranch. My uncle had worked for some company, and he got laid off. And the one aunt also worked for some construction company. I think it was one of the construction companies that was primary in getting rid of the unions. She got laid off because they just stopped working. No building was being done. And then the other aunt worked for See's Candy, and she had a supervisor job there, and so she kept working, but in about the mid-30s, she got cancer, and so she had to quit work. So everybody worked. We always had some kind of a job. My brother and I, just to make a few dimes, we'd gather fruit and take it around the neighbors that lived over into the more populated part of Van Nuys that didn't have big fields around them, that didn't grow stuff. We'd sell them, go pick, pull weeds, mow lawns, and I got deliver newspapers. That was kind of a steady job.
And I'm sure some people are listening to this, and you're describing it like it's no big deal. This is your life. You went through it. You made the best of it. You overcame it. Some people are listening to that and say, "Man, guy went through a lot. His father died when he was 5 years old and had to move back and live with all these other relatives he probably didn't know that well, and everyone's in this together." When you look back on that time now, how do you evaluate it or see maybe what came of it in your life?
Well, when my father died, I was too young to really understand. I knew something bad had happened. It was Irish, had a wake at the house and with the casket in the living room. And I can remember my mother telling my brother and I, there was a kneeler by the casket, come up, and "This is the last time you're going to see your father." Well, I know it was a sad thing. I know everybody's feeling poorly, and it was something bad, but I was just too young to really realize that. But you have to understand one thing. Pictures I have from Portland, Oregon, we were all bundled up, big mufflers and and coats and boot galoshes. How do you go out and play in that? And we come back to San Fernando Valley, and we're out there running around with no shoes and no shirts on. And it was heaven to a young boy that where you come from that atmosphere to what we had, pretty much total freedom.
So you told us you had these aspirations of being an engineer. You're sticking to mathematics. You're going through high school. And while you were in high school is when the world changed and so many lives were changed. Did you have any inkling that war might be coming, that there was a possibility of America being attacked or being drawn into what was already happening in other parts of the world?
Well, we'd hear the adults talking about it, the worry. My uncle was a Marine in World War I, and he didn't want to see us get in the war. He was adamant about going back and bailing out Europe again. So we talked about it, but we really weren't worried. And I can just remember on December 7th, after church, a couple of buddies of mine, I had a Model A Ford then, and we went out driving around and having fun, and we pooled our money so we could go buy a couple of gallons of gas at this little mom-and-pop store with a gas pump. And when we pulled up there, the woman that ran the place came out, and she says, "Well, what do you boys think of the war?" And we thought they were talking about China or Europe, and we said, "Well, hope we don't get in it." And she says, "Oh, we're in it." And I guess there was then that feeling of, well, we will be involved in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I've talked to a lot of folks who were in Southern California at that time, and they say the fear was then, well, the Japanese are coming right here to California. And there were blackouts at night, or they had, you know, air raid wardens that are just waiting to sound the alarm if they spot airplanes. How did your everyday life change in the wake of that news?
Well, I don't think we were really terrified that the Japanese would come in. We were going through that you had to put tape over your headlights so it would just be a little slit. You had to turn all the outside lights off. There was the glare. You know, that's what they were concerned about. Not so much that there'd be planes coming in, but if there's ships at sea, the glare would outline all the buildings and make it easier on their targets. But I think we all had an anticipation, well, we're going to be involved. I know some of my buddies, as soon as they were 17, wanted to go enlist. They had to get their parents' permission, and they could get in the Navy or the Marines. A gentleman from the military came to the school, and particularly to the students in the mathematics classes or the science classes, to take a test so you'd get into this special Army program, the ASTP, Army Specialized Training Program, and we'll teach you how to be engineers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took the test and passed it and then joined the enlisted Reserve Corps.
And by that time, your brother was already in the Navy? And he tried to go in right after Pearl Harbor.
He wanted to go right in.
When he said, I want to be a Marine, what did your uncle say?
No way. He told my mother that if she signed the approval paper, he'd never speak to her again. I can remember that. I was in the living room, and he says, Grace, if you sign that paper, I'll never speak to you again. And so she says, I'm not going to sign the paper. So by the time he did then enlist, and he would have been drafted, he joined the Navy.
Well, and you could have waited to be drafted.
Yes, but it wouldn't have taken much longer. They deferred it until I finished school, because I graduated in June. Then in July, I got my notice and ended up down at Fort MacArthur in the induction center.
One more thing about, you know, December of 41, you hear this shocking news. Your everyday life does change a little bit as far as what you guys have to do and things you never thought of before. Had you known any Japanese Americans in the area? Did you have anyone at school or anything that was Japanese American?
Yes, I had a very close buddy, Jimmy Fujiki. He lived with his father and mother on they had a truck farm too. My uncle and Jimmy's father helped each other out when they were harvesting. They'd support each other. And he was just a good friend. And there in February or March of 42, Jimmy was there one day and the next day he was gone. And we all then was told what happened. We knew what edict that Roosevelt had issued.
Yeah.
And
Executive Order 9066.
So,
did that make sense to you? Was that hard to understand? Hey, this is my friend. We've been working together. We're all in this together. And
well, it's hard to understand, but it was also, I guess it would be the group consciousness of, hey, we've been attacked by Japanese, and they're all around us, and is there a danger?
Just curious, did you ever find out what happened to your friend?
Never.
He never found out the eventual outcome, but he remembers the family selling all their belongings before being sent to an internment camp. If you're a regular Hometown Heroes listener, you've heard a lot about the Japanese-American experience during World War II. But if you'd like to really get a feel for it, I encourage you to catch the traveling exhibit, Courage and Compassion, produced by the Go for Broke National Education Center. I happened to be there in Honolulu last week for the opening of the exhibit there, and a superb speech from Admiral Harry Harris, commander of all our forces in the Pacific, who said he stands on the shoulders of the Nisei warriors of the past. If you're listening in Salem, Oregon today, maybe you saw the exhibit there before it headed to Hawaii. Up next are Monterey and Kingsburg in California. I have a link with all that information for you at hometownheroesradio.com. We're going to get back into Larry Cosgrove's story when we come back. What he did in Europe in the 467th Ordnance Evacuation Company, and you'll get a taste of one of the things that keeps him active at age 92. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.